The Murder Mystery Podcast. The story unfolds each week. Will you guess the killer?
On the Murder Mystery Podcast, it's the London Connection. Episode 20.
Ellen!
Olivia runs down the corridor when she sees the woman just after lunchtime.
We missed each other the last few days. I wanted to ask you something. I'm just going for coffee. I'll come with you.
They walk up to the canteen, buy coffees from the machine, and sit down by the window.
December last year, begins Olivia. The office Christmas lunch. Do you remember?
Sure.
There was a guy came in and started shouting.
Ellen nods.
He shouted at Stephen, mostly, I believe.
I think so.
Some of the blokes bundled him out. Apparently you said you knew him and would talk to him later? Is that right?
Ellen drinks her coffee.
Yes, that is what happened. Who was he?
Says Olivia.
Just a friend of a friend. And why was he shouting at Stephen?
I don't know, really.
Says Ellen.
He said some stuff about losing his job. I can't remember the details. It's a while ago now. What was his name?
Len something. I can't remember.
Says Ellen. It's an obvious lie.
What did you say to him on the day?
I just told him to go home and sober up.
And how he was lucky that he hadn't got into more trouble.
And he just left?
Says Olivia.
Yes, he didn't come back after they threw him out.
There's a brief pause while Olivia wonders if there's any point going on when Ellen is not telling her the truth. Once a witness lies, they have to keep lying to cover themselves. The two of them chat on for a few minutes, then Olivia finishes her coffee and thanks Ellen for the drink before going back to her desk. After work, Olivia walks to the centre of the city. The air is cold against her cheek. She calls the hospital where the man from last night was taken to ask how he is and find out if she can visit him to talk. The nurse who answers sounds annoyed when Olivia mentions the man, as he caused trouble in the accident and emergency department. As soon as he was conscious, he was angry and violent. Then he had disappeared before they'd fully treated him or even found out his name. She walks on, and after a few moments, thinks about Jack. The message from him asking if she'd like to meet up was a surprise when it buzzed into her phone last night. He's a nice guy and good company, she thinks. But she isn't sure she wants anything else from him. Olivia arrives in Trafalgar Square. In the centre of the square, the tree from Norway rises up into the dark amongst the crowds of locals and tourists who've come to be part of London at this time of year. She buys a couple of things for Poppy's Christmas presents. Then Jack appears after 20 minutes through the crowds. They're both slightly nervous and go to find a brasserie. A couple are just leaving as they arrive, so they get the table in the window. From their vantage point, they can see the roving, cheering mass of people outside, happy to be part of something. They order Prosecco and seafood, and the place feels cosy. After they've eaten, they talk about the case.
I was threatened yesterday, says Jack, by some journalist.
Threatened?
Bloody cheek, some of them think they can push their weight around. I knew this guy's dad. I told him that his father would never have done that.
What was he threatening you about?
The Boyd case,
says Jack, looking at her with wide eyes.
Like you, he thinks the guy was murdered. But he accused us of having evidence and covering it up. Some anonymous source of his had got it in their head it was an unlawful killing. No evidence, of course, just random accusations.
I might have some evidence.
Oh, yeah?
A car reg number of the man who's blackmailing Claire Boyd.
How did you get it? He says.
I dropped off the cash last night and saw him pick it up.
Jack sighs.
That's fucking dangerous, Olivia. You should have told me.
Claire asked me.
Will you tell me if you decide to do something like that again?
Probably not,
she says.
Don't be all miserable about it anyway. I got the number. Can you trace the car?
Go on.
It's not the whole plate. It has 4, 7 and ETN in it.
Colour?
No idea. Dark.
Okay. I'll run it.
He makes a note. Olivia has drunk most of the wine and feels playful. She starts a conversation of
things we don't know about each other. My turn first,
she says.
Where were you born?
Croydon.
What did you want to be when you were a kid?
It's boring.
Doesn't matter as long as it's true.
A copper. They laugh.
Last one, then it's your turn,
she says.
What's your middle name?
Oh, shit. It's bad.
Come on, come on.
Allendale.
She bursts out laughing, and he joins in. The Savoy is busy tonight. Adrian arrives early to get a good seat while he waits for Violet. Her call had been a surprise this afternoon, as he thought she had decided not to take him up on his offer. This time, he makes a point of asking what Miss Violet usually drinks, and tells the waiter to have it ready as soon as he sees her arriving. She's wearing a tan coat with an enormous collar, as she makes an entrance which reminds him of old Hollywood. Violet waits for the waiter to take her coat from her shoulders, to reveal a pink sheer dress, bought for her by a Saudi businessman 2 days ago.
Sorry I'm late,
she says.
My chap at lunchtime wouldn't let me go. Charged him double, so drinks are on me.
The waiter appears at that moment with 2 Mai Tai cocktails. She stops and smiles to herself, then looks up at Adrian.
I do like a man who listens.
They pick up the drinks and chink glasses. Then both take a sip.
Now to business, Mr. Gilbraith.
You changed your mind, Violet?
No, an opportunity has come up, and I thought it would be fun to go ahead with your little idea.
What sort of things are we talking here?
Says Adrian.
Sex? Drugs?
Firstly, I want to make a little change. It won't be about the man you mentioned.
That's disappointing. He has a high profile at the moment. And a dead man can't sue.
A bigger fish, though,
she says. And leaves a pause for effect.
Sir Bruce Alpin.
He's a client?
No, he's not.
She smiles in a way that makes him understand her success with men.
And you have what?
Recordings and paperwork.
What's he been up to?
Bribery and fraud over many years,
says Violet.
He's taken money from many people to vote in a certain way in the House when he was MP. And since then he's taken money and made payments to ensure votes and legislation goes in his paymaster's favour. He's also been dealing in various goods which he wouldn't want the public to know about.
He hasn't been an MP for 10 years, though.
The little shit has been doing it for nearly 20 years.
She says.
No drugs or sex, is there?
You journalists have a one-track mind.
2-track, to be fair.
He smiles, and she echoes it. Sir Bruce looks at the brandy in the glass and swirls it around. He remembers watching his own father doing that when he was a boy. But young Bruce wasn't allowed to have alcohol until he was 18. That's the moment he'd realise that you can do anything you like, as long as you appear to be abiding by the rules in public. That glass of brandy that his father swirled had been the start of it. Bruce raises his glass.
To father's,
he says.
You look tired, old man, says Gerald.
Fighting fit as ever. How's your leg these days?
Gerald puts his hand on his left knee.
Mustn't grumble. Blows up in the cold sometimes.
Maybe you should move to the Med, old boy. Mild winters.
I couldn't stand it there, all that bloody sun. Give me the British countryside and hazy light rain any day.
Bruce smiles at his friend and takes another swig of brandy.
Funny you said I was looking tired just now. Actually, I haven't been sleeping that well.
Oh?
I'm concerned about people snooping around our land deals.
That Docklands one? That you got me to buy shares in?
And the others,
said Sir Bruce.
I have a few more, all through a Green Link subsidiary.
Who's snooping around?
That's what I don't know.
Someone asking questions, then? Says Gerald.
The chap who I know, a good friend, said he'd been asked to provide documents about the company. Someone's looking for dirt.
A competitor?
Smells like something more underhand, to be honest,
says Sir Bruce.
Police, maybe.
At that moment, Gerald is taking a mouthful of brandy. He stops, still holding the glass. Nothing to worry about, though. The police have a right to search if they get information. But 90% of the time it comes to nothing, just someone wanting to cause trouble.
I hope you're right, says Sir Bruce.
There's a pause between the two men. Gerald watches Bruce's face. There is nothing to worry about, in that regard. Is there, Bruce?
Of course not.
Bruce, I may be an old duffer, but I can tell when someone's lying. What's going on? Sir Bruce shifts in his seat and raises his hand to the waiter for more alcohol.
Some of the deals...
He pauses to shape his words.
Some of the deals could look unusual if one just saw the paperwork about them.
For God's sake! Gerald wants to raise his voice, but the clientele of White's Club would remember it for years if he did.
What on earth have you been doing?
Nothing to get heated about, Gerald. It's just some of the investors, quite rightly, have wanted to keep their investments private.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning that they can manage their portfolios without getting bombarded with unnecessary taxation.
Gerald has not felt this angry since he was a young man. And by unnecessary taxation, I assume you mean tax avoidance.
Let's not get carried away.
I can't be part of this, Bruce. I need to withdraw my funds from your schemes. I can't be seen to be part of some offshore tax avoidance scam. I'll ask my finance chap to talk to you tomorrow.
You didn't mind 15 years ago, Jerry. You didn't mind it when we made a few bob and managed to slip through the police net then. We did it then. We can do it again, old man.
Ancient history, says Gerald. Long gone. Yes, we got away with it. But that girl didn't, did she? She's in some graveyard somewhere, thanks to us.
And now you're invested in my schemes again, so let's not rock the boat.
Gerald breathes out and closes his eyes for a moment. Then he leans forward and stares at Bruce's face. When the words come, they're slow and deliberate. I'm withdrawing my funds, Bruce. This conversation is over. He stands up and walks to the door of the lounge in White's Club and down the corridor to the front door. There are only two streetlights on the short road that stretches out ahead of Ethan. He sits in his car and watches for activity. The night is quiet. He checks his watch. It's just after 1. The man he had contacted had been very specific about the timing needed to get into the place undetected. Ethan waits for another minute, then pulls the door handle and steps out onto the pavement. He closes the car door as quietly as he can. He is wearing all black, including a woolen hat and thin gloves. He walks 10 yards and stops beside a doorway. He has memorized the door code and stabs at the buttons on a stainless steel panel to one side of the portico. There's a faint click as the door unlocks, and he pushes on into the building. The entrance hall is narrow but has a place for a receptionist's desk to one side that would be manned during office hours. He treads lightly on the carpet and makes his way to the bottom of the stairs ahead of him, then noiselessly up 2 half flights to the first floor. A single door sits on the landing, with a sign next to it that says Green Link Industries, written in white on a blue background. He puts in another code to the lock. Inside, there's a large room in darkness. Outlines of desks, screens and chairs are picked out by the shafts of light coming through the windows dotted down the side wall. There is enough room for 20 desks, but there are only 6 in the place. each with its own assistance desk nearby to delineate a territory belonging to each occupant. At the far end are two offices, which he guesses are for Sir Bruce and Jeremy. He walks the length of the room and into the first office. There's a filing cabinet. This must be Sir Bruce's office. A man who still enjoys dealing in paper, he thinks. Ethan tries the top drawer of the cabinet, but it's locked. He pulls out two hook picks from his pocket and inserts them nimbly into the keyhole. After less than 10 seconds, a clunk sounds as the long bolt drops. He opens the top drawer and starts to read the papers inside, then works his way down the cabinet, pulling out files of interest as he goes. He ends up with 6 that he thinks may have some juicy evidence in them. There's nothing else relevant in that office, so he sweeps into the second room. No filing cabinet here, only a desktop computer. The same contact who provided the door codes gave him the password to Jeremy's machine. He clicks through the icons and folders, then inserts a memory stick into one of the sockets on the machine. He works through the folders and reads as much as he needs to assess whether the files inside it are valuable or not. There are audio files too, and he copies them onto the stick, then selects 4 other documents, which have potentially incriminating information in them. He closes everything down and walks back to the main office. As he reaches the door, he can see the flickering of a torch on the stairwell. He's calm. His experience of doing a break-in like this twice before has given him some bravado. He ducks into the recess where the photocopier sits and waits. Ethan pushes closer to the corner of the wall and looks out towards the doorway. A man with a torch is outside, looking in through the glass, his hand shading one side of his view to eliminate the glare from the stairwell lighting that he turned on before climbing the stairs. Ethan ducks back into the recess. He listens for movement, anything that might tell him what's happening. The man must have tried the door and found it open. He steps into the dark reception area, within 10 feet of Ethan's hiding place. The man walks slowly around the room, bringing his torch to illuminate features. The light cuts across the recess, just beyond Ethan's body. The man walks towards the recess, getting closer with each step. The torchlight explores the walls. Then he turns and walks into the main room. Slowly his confidence rises about making his move, and the route maps out inside his head. Through the reception, out of the door, down the stairs, and out to the street. He makes a single step, then he's away. He walks out of the recess. The other man hears something and plays the torch back in his direction. He sees Ethan as he opens the office door and starts to give chase. Ethan takes the steps down 2 at a time. His balance is slightly ahead of him, and he crashes into the half-landing wall with speed, ramming his shoulder into the exposed brickwork. The man is at the top of the stairs now. Ethan takes the last flight with more speed. He hits the ground floor and runs with all his strength for the door to the street. He hits it hard, pulls at the vast glass door. Then he's outside. The coldness hits him, and he turns towards the car. As he reaches it, the man appears from the office doorway. Ethan throws his bag in first, then drops into the leather of the driving seat and turns the key. Nothing happens. He turns it again. The engine roars, and he pushes on the accelerator hard. A screech of wheel spin echoes between the walls of the houses. The car launches at speed, and he nearly hits a parked car opposite him. The guard runs out into the street and into the path of Ethan's vehicle. But he just pushes the machine harder. The car steams past the guard, who only steps out of the way at the last second. As Ethan reaches the end of the street, he squeals round the corner and shouts a victory cry at the top of his voice. Across London, on a laptop, that Jeremy left in her flat. Violet picks up the mouse and clicks to stop the recording of the CCTV from the Greenlink opposite, then clicks again to download a copy of the video of the CCTV onto a USB stick.